Hello, and welcome back to the Tudors Dynasty podcast. I'm your host, Rebecca Larson. Today, I am joined by the wonderful Lacey Bonar Hall to talk about Anne Boleyn and the Chateau Vert pageant.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The Tudors Dynasty Podcast.
Lacey, welcome.
Hi, Rebecca. How are you?
Oh, I'm good. I'm so happy to have you on the show. I've been following you on Twitter for quite some time.
Oh, well, hey, same. I'm really happy to be here. This is actually, I mean, it's like the highlight of my month. So thank you so much for having me on.
I mentioned that you're a PhD candidate. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so I am a PhD candidate at my university. I also teach for my university. I'm currently writing my dissertation, which is on medieval history, but my initial interest in history is the Tudor period. My dissertation cuts off actually right around like the year 1450, which is kind of a bummer because I, you know, obviously would like to be talking about the reign of Henry VIII, but with different just time parameters and everything, it needed an end date. So the dissertation itself stops at 1450. But I've been taking a lot of classes, writing some papers here and there on Tudor history. And I'm really excited to be talking with you today about my first article that I wrote with History Extra, which is on Anne Boleyn, which is very exciting for me. I've been an Anne Boleyn fan since I was little. She's actually, like for many of us, she's the person who got me interested in the Tudor time period. So I think technically I probably have Anne Boleyn to thank for my dissertation too. She might not be in it, but she inspired it.
Well, and we're not just talking about Anne Boleyn today, but we're going to talk about the Chateau Vert pageant, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. Very, very exciting.
I'm so ashamed to say that I really know very little about pageants in general. And I also assume that I have some listeners out there who are in the same boat as me. Can we just maybe start with you explaining what the point of a pageant was?
Yes, definitely. So a pageant, like a lot of kind of the public displays that happened throughout the Tudor time period, it was all about spectacle and entertainment. So a pageant is, I mean, you're probably familiar with tournaments and with jousts. You might be familiar with like the different masks that they've put on at court. We see some of those depicted in like the Showtime Tudors TV series. But essentially a pageant, it was just a huge public spectacle. So it was typically put on for the people who were present at court. It's something that some of the, you know, highest level courtiers would be invited to. Sometimes different ambassadors would be invited to these pageants. And they were put on to show off prestige and status, essentially, of the rulers. And this is, it's not something that was just unique to England, but we have pageants, especially coming out of the Burgundian courts, which was seen as sort of being like the epitome of class and prestige. And we see a lot of kind of like copycat imitations of different pageants at the Tudor court. It's something that, you know, was happening in France at the French court. Pageants were very popular throughout the 16th century. Henry VIII had a lot of different pageants occurring throughout his reign. Some of the bigger displays often corresponded with important religious celebrations, like different celebrations around Epiphany or Shrovetide. And then the Chateau Vert pageant that we're actually talking about today, it was really the culmination of the 1522 Shrovetide celebrations. And it took place on the evening of Shrove Tuesday. Now, the Shrovetide celebrations themselves, they had always been just absolutely massive celebrations of plenty and partying and eating a lot and drinking a lot and just having a really good time, because it was the couple of days before the start of the Lenten season, which was known to be, you know, a lot more austere. It was about limitation, where things really calmed down. So this pageant that we're talking about today, it actually took place the day before Lent started. So just to kind of set the scene of how just absolutely wild those couple of days of celebration would be, the Tudors knew that they were in for a season of calmness. So they were trying to get all of their partying and good times out while they could.
And what's, correct me if I'm mistaken, Shrove Tuesday was the day before Ash Wednesday.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, it was.
Okay. I just have to set my timeline there.
So, well, yeah. And I think, you know, for us today, if you're religious, I don't think we have the same type of like mental understanding of what these religious holidays really would have meant for people in the medieval and early modern. So, you know, the Tudor period, where so much really revolved around the religious calendar. I mean, it's how people organized their lives. It's how they organized their events. They took these different religious celebrations really seriously. And it can be kind of hard, you know, in a modern mindset to try and put ourselves back into the mindset of someone in 1522 and what the Shrovetide celebrations, you know, would have looked like. With the Chateau Vert pageant, it wasn't even just Shrovetide that was being celebrated. It was also a very successful visit by the imperial ambassadors of Charles V. So if you're thinking about like the foreign relations policy that typically happened throughout Henry VIII's reign, it's like he was always trying to team up with either Francis I against Emperor Charles V, or he was teaming up with Charles V against King Francis I. And this actually, you know, it's kind of funny how that those two relationships that Henry had with those two fellow rulers is really kind of mirrored in like the movement of Anne Boleyn, which, you know, I know we'll get to that in a minute, but it's, you know, just something I was thinking about while I was writing this piece for History Extra, is that Henry, he was working with the Holy Roman Emperor. So he was working with Maximilian I. Back in 1513, when Anne Boleyn went to the court of Margaret of Austria, and Henry's sister, Mary Tudor, who would go on to become Mary Tudor Brandon, was actually betrothed to the future Charles V at the time. And then, you know, Thomas Boleyn was serving as an ambassador to Margaret of Austria's court, and he secured a place for his daughter Anne at her court. And then when the betrothal between Mary Tudor and Charles V was called off, Thomas Boleyn snatches Anne back from Margaret of Austria's court and instead sends her to France, where Mary Tudor was to marry King Louis XII in 1514. And Anne was there to actually serve Mary Tudor in her role as the new French queen. And then when we get to the Chateau Vert pageant, now in 1522, Anne again was pulled, this time from France, to come back to England, because now Henry was working against Francis I of France, and instead he was teaming up with the emperor again. And this, the Chateau Vert pageant, it was really put on to celebrate the fact that Henry was teaming up with Charles V and that they were instead going to take on now the common enemy of Francis I. So it's interesting that this one pageant, it has a lot of religious symbolism tied up in it, but then it's also really a celebration of these like really important diplomatic ties. And of course the ambassadors, the Charles V's ambassadors were the guests of honor at the pageant itself. So it gives us some interesting insight into a lot of different layers of what was going on with Henry in his court back in 1522.
I can just imagine how exciting everything was. I mean, oh, he was still young at that time, relatively.
Yeah. So Henry was, I think he was 30 when in 1522, I hope my math's right. I'm not the best at mental math. I'm a historian.
That sounds about right.
but yeah, I think he was 30, almost 31. So yeah, he was, you know, young, he was sort of in his prime. And so was Catherine of Aragon, his queen. So it would have been, it's like one of those top 10 events in history that if I could go be a fly on the wall and witness a historical event, this one is definitely, this pageant is in my top 10 list of events that I would like to have seen. Just, I mean, just for the pageant itself, but also because of just the really remarkable people who participated and who, you know, watched the pageant.
Yeah. Oh, I can't wait. Okay, let's talk more. So okay. I have so many questions. Let's just start with the name. I've slaughtered how to say it. So
you're okay. It's French. I think you can be excused. It just means Green Castle. And it is really just in, I mean, they weren't super creative with this name. It is in reference to the set. So the set of the pageant was just a massive green castle that actually had, I mean, it was big enough to have women standing inside of it, sort of like on display, but also to have musicians hidden within it.
I can't even imagine.
Who were playing like the background music, which to me, that's one of the little details. I just absolutely love imagining that there are so many of these court musicians hidden within the walls of this big castle, and just like the ambiance of that pageant. I mean, it just had to be absolutely incredible to witness.
I was wondering if the green had something to do with the Tudor green.
You know, I don't know. It might. They had a lot of different pageants that I know they had, like the Chateau Blanc, which was the white castle. It was, you know, a couple years after the Chateau Vert pageant. So I don't know if they were just that uncreative with their names that they just named them very visually based on, you know, what the set actually looked like, or if maybe there was a deeper meaning. I know in any of the research I've done, there hasn't been much discussion of like, why did they choose green? But it was, you know, maybe it did have a deeper meaning than this, that someone like green, because they did, the whole set was very much green. I mean, there was green tinfoil, there were green battlements, there were these, all of these banners that were decorative. It was really like a visual feast, and green was definitely the predominant color of choice.
Yeah.
So that's a good idea, Rebecca. I'll have to see if I can find anything more, to look into that.
So I'm curious, now that you've mentioned it, who was responsible for naming the pageant? Who organized these? What was all involved with sets and costumes?
So it's a lot. And I'm glad you asked that question. So the pageant itself, and really a lot of Henry's biggest celebrations, they were organized by a man named William Cornish, who was the master of the Royal Chapel Choristers. So Cornish, he had actually been heavily involved with court pageants since at least the year 1501. So that's one of the earliest records that I've been able to find that mention William Cornish is about a pageant that he helped produce back in 1501. So he would have been working then under King Henry VII, and then would have continued on those duties under Henry VIII. So while he was working for Henry VIII, I mean, things, they really ramped up as far as like courtly displays goes under Henry VIII. I think one thing that we know about Henry is that he was very much always the main character. He liked to have a lot of attention on him. He liked to really, I mean, he knew how to celebrate, and he had a lot of different pageants and disguises and tournaments and jousts throughout his reign. And William Cornish was really a key player in a lot of these different performances. A lot of the performances that William Cornish wrote and that he directed and that he produced actually featured the king himself, like the Chateau Vert pageant. We'll be talking about Henry's role in that pageant here in a little bit. But they also often featured Catherine of Aragon, who interestingly doesn't feature in the Chateau Vert pageant, but had participated and even often had speaking roles in the pageants throughout like the 1510s and early on in 1520. But yeah, she actually didn't feature in this one in 1522. But historians do think that Cornish, he likely wrote this pageant. He likely directed it. He even played a really key role in the pageant. So he had a speaking part, which he gave to himself, which I think is really fun. He's one of those people who I would have liked to have met because he had a lot of creativity in, you know, the different scenes he helped put together. Pageants on like a wide variety of topics. Most of them fall under that courtly love theme, which is very much something that the Tudors were really concerned with, the idea of chivalry and unrequited love, which was the theme of the Chateau Vert pageant. But we also have the name of a man named Richard Gibson, who was also really heavily involved in producing these pageants. And he kept really detailed accounts on just some of the most minute charges that came out of these pageants, because they were not cheap affairs. The pageants, the masks, all of these disguisings, they cost the crown a lot of money. And Richard Gibson is the one who, he just really meticulously recorded what a lot of these pageants cost. And he also is to thank for recording the names of a lot of the participants in the different pageants throughout the early years of Henry's reign. So he, for the Chateau Vert pageant, he records that it cost about £2.08 and 4p, which today would seem like nothing. But at the time, it was the equivalent of the pay that was earned by a skilled tradesman for 80 days of labor. So this one, really just the set of the Chateau Vert pageant, and, you know, it had some elaborate costumes too, but mostly the set of the pageant, it cost just astronomical amount for an hour of celebration, really. But it was, again, it was done because Henry wanted to impress his courtiers, and he really wanted to impress the ambassadors. So there really was no expense spared on this set. Like I said, it was just an absolutely massive green castle. It took carpenters, painters, and laborers about 2 weeks to put the entire thing together. They started working on it on February 20th of 1522, and they finished working on it on March 4th. And we're told that on March 4th, it was transported up the River Thames on a barge with 5 men rowing it from the place where it was constructed to Wolsey's townhome, where the pageant actually happened. So it's, I really like to imagine looking, just being like an ordinary person walking down the street in 1522 London, and you look over and just going up the river is a humongous green castle. And you have to think people probably just thought, oh, Henry's at it again.
Can you imagine?
I just absolutely love it. I think I'm like a really visual type of person. So there are a lot of instances with this pageant that I like to just imagine what it would have been like to witness, because it's something just so out of the ordinary of what of anything that I've witnessed in my life. You know, I've been to like school plays and that sort of thing, but never anything like this. And it's just, it's fun to think about just what that must have been like to see, you know, whether you're someone who just catches a glimpse of that castle going up the river, or if you're, you know, lucky enough to be someone who's sitting in an audience and gets to watch this pageant actually be put on, it would just be a sight. I should also say that Richard Gibson, I know that, you know, there are a lot of people out there who like to learn about clothing history, which is really fascinating, especially for the Tudor era, because some of those gowns that that women would have worn at the time were just amazing. So I should say that Richard Gibson, he records the purchase of fabric from a man named William Boter for the women's costumes. And the women, so there were 8 women in this pageant, which, you know, we'll talk about those particular women here in a couple of minutes. But there were 8 women who, I mean, they were absolutely decked out in the latest fashions. They had on fine white satin gowns made in the Milanese style. So very, you know, Italian, very ornate. They also wore bonnets that were decorated with jewels. And then they wore what's called a caul. So it's C-A-U-L. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. But it essentially was a covering for women's hair. So if you picture like a bun type of hairstyle, a caul would have covered over the bun portion. And that was made of Venetian gold. So it also, you know, that cost a good amount, which is why Richard Gibson recorded the women's outfits and you know, how much they spent on something like that. But again, to be someone who was selected to be in this pageant and to be entrusted to wear such expensive outfits, you had to be someone pretty special to be involved in this.
Like Anne Boleyn.
Like Anne Boleyn, yeah.
Let's talk about, everybody's here for Anne Boleyn. Let's talk about.
Who isn't, Rebecca? I'm certainly here for Anne Boleyn.
Why don't we go back? Because you had mentioned she was in France in 1514, and then she had to return to England. Can you tell us a little bit more maybe about Anne's life at the time of the pageant?
Yeah, so she had just returned to England. I mean, she had only been back for, most historians think, probably right around 4 months. So she likely left France in late 1521, probably right around Christmas time, and would have come back to England. And it was her first time that we know of being back in England since she left when she was 12 years old in 1513.
Oh, wow.
So by the time she came back, she was 21. You have to wonder how much she even recognized when she came back to England. She had had pretty regular contact with her father. We think she also likely would have seen her mother and maybe Mary at the Field of Cloth of Gold in 1520. So she would have, you know, seen her family, but she wouldn't have actually seen her home. So she was 21 years old or thereabouts. You know, the Anne's birth date is something that's really highly contested with historians, but let's say she was probably about 20 or 21 years old when she came back, and she would have likely spent a decent amount of time at Henry's court before she was asked to be in the pageant. Things are pretty fuzzy as far as details of Anne's couple of months in England before this pageant. And, you know, they're fuzzy after this pageant because it was still going to be another couple of years before we start to see Anne featuring heavily in accounts as someone who caught the king's eye. But we do know that her father, Thomas Boleyn, had served Henry VIII throughout his entire reign, and her mother was a member of the prominent Howard family. So Anne, when she came back to England, she had a lot of strong family connections, but she was still new to court. We don't know exactly the role that she played at court, but we know that obviously she was there for a reason when she was selected to be in the pageant. She may have been selected due to her father's popularity with Henry. She was also someone who was getting a lot of attention from Cardinal Wolsey, who was really Henry's right-hand man at the time, because Wolsey was planning to use Anne as, I don't want to say like a bargaining chip, because that, you know, sounds a little horrible, but he was hoping to use Anne to placate a feud that had been going on between Anne's father, Thomas, and the Butler family. They were fighting over who got to become the Earl of Ormond. So he was hoping to marry Anne into the Butler family to kind of quash that argument that had been going on. She would have had some connections. She obviously also was close with her sister, who also took part in the Chateau Vert pageant. Her sister actually had married William Carey just 2 years before the pageant, and William Carey himself was a big favorite of King Henry VIII, and Henry had actually been a guest at their wedding. So the Boleyn family at the time, you know, they were really well connected, and this is sort of like the web of connections that Anne stepped back into at the court, which I think helps to provide a little bit of context into why she was chosen to participate. I mean, only 8 women of the court were chosen to participate in this pageant, and Anne and her sister Mary were two of the eight. So I think it speaks a lot to the status of the Boleyn family and how popular they were at Henry's court.
Yeah, I agree. Can you maybe tell us a little bit more about Anne's role and some of the other women who participated alongside her? Because I, in my head, I think of Anne Boleyn and Henry VIII's sister, Mary. Other than that, I'm a blank slate. So who else was there and what roles did they play?
Yeah, so it's a good question. We unfortunately don't have the names of every single woman. We're missing the name for one of the eight. And then two of the eight, we have names for, but we don't have exact identities. But for five of the eight women who participated, we have their names, we have their identities, and we have a decent amount of background information. For women living in the 1520s, if you weren't royalty, it's hard to find information. Even sometimes if you were royalty, it's hard to find information, but we're lucky that we can piece together, you know, a little bit of information about most of these women. So there's obviously Anne Boleyn, who we all know. There is her sister, Mary Boleyn Carey, who also participated in the pageant. There's Mary Tudor Brandon, like you said, who was the French queen who Anne had served in 1514 when she married Louis XII of France, but he quickly died and she returned to England to her brother's court with her new husband, Charles Brandon, the Duke of Suffolk in tow, which created quite a scandal. But things had calmed down by 1522 and she was reinstated to her place at the center of a lot of these courtly pageants, which she had participated in from the time she was a young child. So Mary Tudor Brandon. And then the fourth is Gertrude Courtenay, who was the Countess of Devon. And then there's Jane Parker, who would go on to become Jane Parker Boleyn when she married Anne's brother, George. Now, the two women that we have names for, there is a Mistress Brown and a Mistress Danette. We don't know exactly the identities of these women. We aren't sure who they are, but at least have the two last names. And then there's just a blank in Gibson's record for the last woman. The eighth woman doesn't have a name. It's left blank in the manuscript.
Wow. How would you like to be that woman?
I know. I have spent a lot of time thinking about why that happened. Why? Because Richard Gibson, in most of his accounts, I mean, he's really meticulous in his detail. He writes down the names. When he writes down the names of people who participate, I mean, you know, you can be pretty sure that what he's writing down is accurate. And I do not know why he doesn't include that last woman, why he goes out of the way to name all of the other seven. And then the last one is just left blank, is kind of mind boggling to
curious.
Me. I don't know exactly why. Yeah. I don't know why that would happen. Come up with a lot of theories.
Right. I hate to see that's the stuff that sends you down rabbit holes. You don't need to go down.
Oh, it does. And it's all the stuff that cannot be proven.
Right.
So it's fun to think about, but it doesn't necessarily get you anywhere, or at least, you know, you can't say with any sort of confidence that you have solved that mystery.
Oh, man.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, but we do know that they held roles in this pageant.
We do, which is that's what I was about to say, because we know that these women held roles, but we don't know exactly which role they played. So this is, it's an interesting conversation. We had, and by we, I mean, you know, people who, like the Anne Boleyn fangirls, the people who study Anne Boleyn, we had assumed because of Eric Ives' biography of Anne Boleyn that she played the role of Perseverance. And that has kind of been just like a given with Anne Boleyn, that she was in the Chateau Vert pageant. It was her first recorded appearance at Henry VIII's court, and she played Perseverance. And, you know, look how amazing that is when you look at the like personal qualities that she displayed later on in Henry's reign. The interesting thing is that we don't actually know that. There is another Tudor scholar on Twitter, James Taff, if you would like to follow him. His handle is just @James_Taff. And he posed the question for the 500-year anniversary of the Chateau Vert pageant of how do we actually know that Anne played the role of Perseverance? What record is this in? And a couple of us on Twitter took up the challenge. And it's not in the primary sources. The primary sources for the Chateau Vert pageant are Richard Gibson's account, which gives us the names of the women who participated, and Edward Hall's chronicle, which gives us a lot of detail about the pageant itself, and it gives us the roles, so the character names, but not the women's names. What it looks like likely happened is that Eric Ives, when he was writing his biography, unless he had access to some source that the rest of us, over the last, 30 or 40 years haven't had access to, it looks like what likely happened is that he combined the list of character names from Edward Hall with the list of women's names from Richard Gibson and matched them up accordingly. So if that's the case, then Anne Boleyn did play Perseverance, which is what Eric Ives says. Mary Boleyn would have played Kindness, which from what we know about Mary Boleyn's life would have been an apt character for her to play. Mary Tudor Brandon would have played Beauty, which again, she was really well known throughout, not just throughout England, but really throughout Europe as being one of the great beauties. Gertrude Courtenay would have played Honor. Whoever Mistress Brown is likely would have played Bounty. Mistress Danette likely would have played Pity. And then this unnamed eighth woman, Mistress Danette would have played Mercy. And then the unknown eighth woman would have likely played Pity. Now, I think it's not unreasonable to think that might have been the case because people at the time would have known the ranks of these women, and both Edward Hall and Richard Gibson might have listed these women in order of their rank. We just can't know that for sure. So it's really another one of those mysteries, and a mystery that I think took a lot of us really by surprise to realize that it is a mystery. Thanks to James's post on Twitter that it was just kind of like inherited knowledge for a lot of us. The Ives biography, I don't know if you have looked at that at all, but I mean, it is like the work on Anne Boleyn. He is a fantastic historian who has really, put his time in with these sources and has compiled a biography that I think most people would say is kind of like the standard Anne Boleyn biography. And I think it's easy to take that as being uncontested fact, when in fact we don't actually have the concrete evidence from 1522 saying that these are the roles played by these particular women. So it's interesting. It's something that I'm hoping to look more into, throughout my career to see what we can actually pin down.
Yeah.
But yeah, as far as I know, we can't say for certain that she did play Perseverance. But man, wouldn't it just be, it is the role that she should have played.
It seems fitting, definitely.
Yeah, it definitely does.
I'm stuck on this Ives thing because in my head, that was always the Bible on Anne.
Yes.
If you want to know the real story of Anne, go to Eric Ives. Now, yeah. You mentioned that he was the first here to mention it. Did he source it in his book?
He did. And I had just looked at that a couple of days ago when I was making some notes because I knew, I wanted to talk about this with you. So from what I remember, he has only provided the same printed sources that we all looked at when we were having this conversation on Twitter. It's not, so I was hoping to find, like a manuscript source, maybe something in the British Library or the National Archives that I could maybe, go look at myself. And no, it's all ambassador records. It's the He depends heavily on Edward Hall, which, you know, everyone does, who writes on the Chateau Vert pageant, because Edward Hall is the person who gives us just, I mean, he describes the pageant in a ton of detail. And then he uses Richard Gibson's account. So it's
interesting.
Yeah, it was, I had the same feeling where I was like, oh no, I use Eric Ives for everything.
Right.
And like I said, I don't, you know, I would not say he's wrong. Who am I, a PhD student, to question Eric Ives? He very well could be right. It's just that we don't know exactly, because we cannot be positive that Hall and Gibson both named these women according to rank. We can think it's likely, and I do think it's likely, but we can't say just with complete certainty that that was the case. We do know the 8 roles and the 7 women who played them, but we, you know, can't match up the women with the roles.
It's so frustrating being a researcher, and you just want that hard evidence to say yes or no. And then you're left with that gray area. And if you decide to take that leap and make an assumption, well, you better have something to back that up.
Yes. Yeah. That's what a couple of us were talking on Twitter about. How many books would need to have like a little asterisk that would say in a footnote, like, this is what we think, but we're not 100% sure. Because I mean, it really is, since Ives's biography came out, you just see it being repeated over and over, because who questions Eric Ives? And, you know, maybe we don't necessarily need to, maybe it's not, you know, important to know the exact role that these women played, and instead to just know that they were selected to take part in this pageant. But I think a lot of people, myself included, have tried to draw, you know, some interesting parallels between the women and their personalities and the roles that they were supposedly assigned in this pageant, because it is, I mean, it's just really, really interesting to think of Anne bursting on the scene at Henry's court playing Perseverance, because it is just such foreshadowing about everything that we know about Anne as queen and as, you know, Henry's mistress. But we just can't say it 100%.
I want to go back to something that you had mentioned earlier about the pageant itself being held at Wolsey's townhouse. Mm-hmm. Is that what you said?
Yeah, it was his one of his London residences.
Do we know what it was called?
Yeah. So at the time it was called York Place. And it was really just where Wolsey himself lived. It didn't have like a ton of space for lodging, but it was a common place for him to host ambassadors, which is what he was doing at the Shrovetide celebration. So he's likely the person who really organized this celebration. He was probably, you know, working pretty closely with getting the set and everything set up in his home. And then he, of course, you know, was the host. He had put on a big supper right prior to the pageant. And then Edward Hall tells us that after supper, he led the ambassadors and likely also Queen Catherine of Aragon into his great hall so that they could sit down, take their places and watch the pageant unfold. So his York Place it just had to be absolutely gorgeous. It unfortunately no longer remains, but we are given a pretty good description of his great hall at York Place. Edward Hall tells us that it was hung with rich tapestries. It had cloth of estate hanging from the ceiling. It was lit by just dozens and dozens of candles, and that Wolsey would have led the audience down through the room until they got to the far end of the great hall, where they were met with this just massive green wooden castle. And that the castle itself, it had 3 towers. It had a really big central tower that actually had a lantern burning in it, so it would have had fire that would have illuminated the entire castle. And then it had 2 smaller towers on each side. Like I said a little bit earlier, it was covered in green tinfoil, which just, I mean, if you can think about the candlelight and the tinfoil, it had to just be quite a sight to see. And then each tower had its own banner hanging off of it. And it really, the whole thing was structured around this theme of unrequited love, which is, you know, something that we see popping up a lot in the courtly love narratives. But each of these three banners depicted a different scene of unrequited love. So one was three broken hearts. One banner was a woman's hand clenching a man's heart. And then the other one was, it was similar. It was a woman's hand clenching a man's heart, but actually turning it upside down. So it was supposed to indicate lovesickness. And then, like I said, you know, there were those musicians who were hidden in there, and they were concealed within the castle walls. And then in the three towers of the castle were distributed these eight women, the women who we were just talking about, Anne Boleyn and the other women. And they were all playing the roles of the feminine virtues. And so that's where you get perseverance, kindness, beauty, honor, constancy, bounty, mercy, and pity, because those were seen as being sort of like the ideals, the ideal characteristics that would be inhabited by women. Now, the really interesting thing for me is that if you're sitting in the audience, you were looking up at this castle, but what you were looking at directly in front of you are these young boys who were the choristers of the royal chapel, and they were dressed as Indian women, and they were playing the roles of the feminine vices. So these young boys were playing the role of danger, disdain, jealousy, unkindness, scorn, malbouche, which is really like inappropriate speech, and then strangeness. And they, so that's who would have been immediately right in front of the audience, are these young boys who are dressed up to be like the bad guys, I guess, of the pageant. And they were jealously guarding the women who were standing up in the towers. So it had to have just been, you know, just amazing what all you were trying to take in as an audience member, because there was this just elaborate set in front of you. And then these 16 people who, you know, were just dressed so outrageously. And you know, you were just waiting for the show to start.
Was there singing and dancing?
There was, but not until the end. So Henry, when the pageant was ready to start, Henry and a group of men would have burst into the room. They were led by this character named Ardent Desire, which we think that this was likely played by William Cornish, the man who produced and wrote and directed the pageant. He would have been dressed in crimson satin that was decorated with burning flames of gold to show you that he was Ardent Desire. And he led the men forwards up to the castle. Now the men, which was Henry and a couple men of his court, they were dressed in caps of cloth of gold, and then they were wearing mantle cloaks of blue satin. And on these mantle cloaks, they had their names written in blue letters on scrolls of yellow damask, and they were fixed onto their mantle cloak. So each of them had, like the women, each of them had a different masculine virtue that was the character they were playing, and it was their name, and it was fixed onto their costume. So there was amorousness, which was likely played by Henry himself, and then nobleness, youth, attendance, loyalty, pleasure, gentleness, and liberty. And we unfortunately don't have the names of the other men. I have some ideas of who they might have been, but not going to venture into that. But it was, you know, it would have been different men who were of Henry's court and who were close to him. Now, all of these men and Anne Boleyn and the other virtues were masked. So they had masks on to try and hide their true identities, which is something that was common at Henry's court. They had a lot of masks or disguisings, but it was something that was really important with the Chateau Vert pageant. So when Henry and his men were standing in front of the castle, this is when we have Ardent Desire, likely William Cornish, ask the ladies to give the castle over, but they refused. So Ardent Desire rallied the men. He told them to just go ahead and take the castle by force. So Henry, leading the men, started to attack the castle. And this is when the audience would have heard cannons being set off outside the walls of Wolsey's home. So there were men stationed outside just waiting for the go ahead to set off these cannons. And the walls, you know, would have been shaking.
Wow.
Henry and his men were advancing on this castle. It all would have been very dramatic. So the men, they were throwing fruit at the women. That was their weapon that they chose to use. So they were throwing like oranges and dates at the women, while these choristers who were dressed up as the feminine vices, they were throwing rose water on the men while they were attacking. And this, you know, this attack scene, of course, why wouldn't you? This attack scene went on for a little bit, but then unsurprisingly, Henry and his men ended up winning, which I'm sure was a shock to absolutely no one who was used to watching Henry's pageants. So he and the men ended up winning. They chased off the feminine vices, and then each man went up into the Chateau Vert, and they took one of the feminine virtues by the hand, and they led their virtue down from the castle onto the dance floor, where they put on dances to what we're told is the absolute delight of the audience. Now, when the dancing was done and the music would have stopped, then all the participants took off their masks and would have revealed, you know, who they actually were. So it would have been a sight to see. I'm gonna go out on a limb and say that at least Henry would have been highly recognizable. I don't think his mask was probably hiding who he was for most of the audience. But, you know, you would assume that Thomas Boleyn certainly would have recognized his daughters. But the mask just, you know, it added in like an element of suspense, which is something that was important in Tudor pageantry.
That sounds so exciting. So clearly they had practiced having the cannons go off in time. Do we know if the participants practiced at all, or did they just show up on the, is there anything in the records that tells us this?
No. And I wish there was. That's something I was thinking about actually just today when I was thinking about talking with you about this, is that because it was so choreographed, they would have had to have practiced. I mean, we have a little bit of dialogue, mostly between Ardent Desire and a couple of the choristers. And certainly he would have been familiar with the choristers because he was, you know, their director too. So I'm sure, you know, they could have practiced their dialogue on the side, but the virtues, the feminine virtues and the masculine virtues, still would have had to have known, you know, what to do. They likely wouldn't have had the set there to practice with much ahead of time, because we're told that they were still working on the set up until the 4th of March, which is when this was put on. But you would imagine that there had to have been coordination, because they had to coordinate the costumes. They had to coordinate the fruits and the rose water, their weapons that they used. So that's something I was thinking about, that I wish we knew more detail about all of the background work that went into this. We're unfortunately only told about the pageant itself, but it's also, you know, it's good that we're even just told about the pageant itself, that Edward Hall thought that it was important enough to talk about it, and that Richard Gibson took the charges seriously enough that he recorded them in great detail, so that we, you know, we even know that something like this happened. But no, we unfortunately don't know much about any of the background work that went into it, aside from like the laborers who worked on the set itself.
There's so much about Anne Boleyn's history that we just don't know, isn't there?
Yeah, there really is. She's kind of like an enigma, that she, even when we know her, I feel like we don't really know her. We're always very much looking at her through the lens of hindsight. You know, we're thinking about her as being Henry's tragic downfallen queen. We're not always thinking about her in her own right. And so that's something that when I was writing about the pageant, I did try and put myself in Anne's shoes. So like if I just came, I mean, I'm fresh at court, you know, at this court that my sister is pretty established at. My parents, you know, have been working with this king and with previous monarchs for a while, but this is, you know, this is my first time, right? It's my moment to kind of like start establishing myself as a woman at this court. And just how excited and nervous she must have been standing up in that tower, because there are a lot of eyes on you, and the eyes that are on you are important eyes. And you would definitely be feeling the pressure, but also the excitement of being able to be involved in something like that, which it probably wouldn't have been Anne's first time being involved in a big court festivity. Certainly she was likely involved in similar types of festivities in France when she was serving a Queen Claude. but it would have been her first time at the English court.
So you said earlier, we were talking about your History Extra article, and you mentioned how this pageant foreshadowed Anne's tumultuous future. Can you elaborate on that?
I can. Yeah. So this is really one of the things I was really interested in writing about with the pageant. The pageant itself, I think, is, you know, fascinating. And like I said, it's an event that I wish I would have witnessed. But what I find really intriguing about the pageant is how it, I mean, it really foreshadowed Anne's time as queen. So first, we can just look at the women who participated with her. So Mary Tudor Brandon, the sister of Henry VIII, like we were talking about earlier, of course, Anne was decently familiar with Mary Tudor Brandon because she had served her as Queen of France, but Anne obviously stayed on in France while Mary returned to England. Mary was known for being really close with Catherine of Aragon. They grew up together. They were very much sisters. And when Henry took an interest in Anne, Mary was, she was devastated, and she was very openly against it. She is one of the few people who spoke out against the relationship without really fearing the consequences. She was Henry's favorite sister. They had always been really close. And I think she felt like that gave her a little bit of freedom to criticize what her brother was doing when, you know, not many people criticized Henry VIII and lived to tell about
it,
at least. But yeah, she was not a fan of Anne. She made it perfectly clear that she was not a fan of Anne. And there's actually one instance in early 1532, so a decade after the Chateau Vert pageant, where Mary Tudor Brandon used what is called opprobrious speech against Anne. And this actually escalated into a brawl between men of the Duke of Suffolk. So that's Mary Tudor Brandon's husband, Charles Brandon, and men of the Duke of Norfolk, which is Anne's uncle, the Duke of Norfolk. And they ended up fighting. It was violent. One man who was actually a relative of Charles Brandon was killed. And the records say that if Charles Brandon had actually been there to witness it, then the court assumed that there would have been just tumult. It would have been, you know, really horrible, the aftermath of that. But they were able to smooth things over, at least between Brandon and the men at Henry's court. But Mary and Anne never did smooth things over, as far as we can tell. And Mary actually refused to go to Anne's coronation, which probably had a personal element to it. But then also at the same time, Mary was not well. She was in really ill health. And she actually ended up dying less than a month after Anne's coronation. But she, you know, never ended up voicing her support for her brother's new relationship. And then there's Gertrude Courtenay, who was the Countess of Devon, who participated alongside Anne. She was another person who was really loyal to Catherine of Aragon throughout the remainder of Catherine's life. And she, again, was no friend to Anne, and she made that pretty clear. She also refused to attend Anne's coronation in 1533, and this really made Henry just absolutely furious to not have the support of the Countess. And so he actually ended up making her, which this is really petty, but he ended up making her serve as godmother to Henry and Anne's daughter, Elizabeth, to sort of teach her a lesson for not being supportive of Anne. It didn't work. She didn't end up ever liking Anne. She actually allegedly, which, you know, is unsurprising that I don't think, you know, something like that is going to make someone change their mind.
I love it when people force me to do things.
Oh my gosh, I know. I was like, it's not going to work. But Henry tried, and she didn't tell him no. She, you know, she took part. I think she ended up giving her like some silver plate or something like that to Elizabeth. So she played her role the way that she had to, but she allegedly also became an informant for Chapuis. I never know exactly how to say it. I've heard it pronounced a couple of different times. I'm going to go with Chapuis if you don't mind. But she allegedly became an informant for him, and she passed along information about Anne and Henry to Emperor Charles V through ambassador, and who, you know, was also a known enemy to Anne. Some historians think that Gertrude is actually the person who accused Anne of witchcraft in January of 1536, which is an accusation that, you know, it really stuck with her. There are even still people today who think that Anne Boleyn was a practicing witch and that she had, you know, the six fingers on one hand and all that stuff. But she supposedly, Gertrude, told the ambassador that Henry wanted to be rid of Anne and that he claimed that she had used charms and sorcery to ensnare him in the first place, which kicked off major distrust of Anne and helped play a role in her downfall in May of 1536. And then Jane Parker, the story is a little bit more complicated with Jane Parker. She would obviously go on to marry George Boleyn and become Lady Rochford. And she, I feel like she's really just been used as a scapegoat. A lot of people think that she is responsible for the downfall of the Boleyn family. There were rumors that she is the person who informed Henry of Anne's alleged adultery, but this, you know, isn't something that's discussed in any reliable historical sources. Some people think that she even implicated her own husband, George, and that she is partly to blame for him having the charges of incest and treason lodged against him. I think that's a little bit murkier to me, but it's, you know, it's something that, again, like the witchcraft accusations have stuck with Anne throughout history, the Jane Parker Boleyn as being the downfall of the Boleyn family is unfortunately something that has stuck with her reputation even to today. And then Mary Boleyn, obviously Anne's sister, who went on to have an affair with the king, maybe was having her affair with the king during the Chateau Vert pageant. We don't have the exact dates of that affair, but when we do know that they had an affair, because when Henry wanted to marry Anne, he had to apply for a papal dispensation to excuse his sexual relationship with her sister, which it allowed for like the religious impediment to be removed, but a lot of people still looked on the Henry and Anne relationship with suspicion, not just because of Catherine of Aragon, but also because Henry had had that relationship with Anne's sister as well. And then just I feel like the theme of unrequited love or this unattainable love is something that is really, you know, it foreshadows the relationship that Henry and Anne would go on to have. I'm sure most of your listeners are familiar with the King's Great Matter, with Henry's struggle to divorce Catherine of Aragon because he wanted to marry Anne Boleyn, and then the hardships that they had even when they did get married of not being able to produce any male offspring. Obviously, they ended up having Elizabeth I, who, thanks to hindsight, we know ended up being arguably the greatest Tudor monarch, one of the greatest monarchs in all of English history, according to some people. But at the time, it made for a really tumultuous relationship between Henry and Anne, and eventually helped to lead to Anne's grisly downfall. Before we get to that point in history, though, Henry and Anne lived in a palace called Whitehall Palace, which actually was Wolsey's York Place townhome, which to me is just completely mind-blowing, that the place where Anne first steps onto the historical record at Henry's court is the palace that she lives in as the first queen to live in that palace. So when Wolsey fell from power, Henry ended up acquiring York Place. And in autumn of 1529, Henry and Anne, they, you know, weren't married yet, but they were very much together, and it was very much known that they were together. They took a barge down the Thames to York Place. They fell in love with the residents, and they spent that Christmas, so Christmas of 1529, at Greenwich Palace, designing a whole new palace at York Place that they would be moving into. Henry's master carpenter was likely put in charge of building. They came up with the plans that winter, and it was just an absolutely massive palace. They used the old residence, so the residence that Wolsey had lived in where the pageant took place, they actually used that as part of the residential portion of Henry and Anne's new palace. And they spent time at the palace while it was being constructed. And actually, and this is at least for me, enough to give me goosebumps, Henry and Anne were married at Whitehall Palace, so York Place, in secret in January of 1533. And they also held her coronation celebrations at Whitehall Palace in June of 1533. So it is, to me, it's just so interesting to think about how far Anne Boleyn had come in really, you know, those 10 years from 1522 to 1533, to where she was participating in this pageant as a member of Henry VIII's court in 1522. And then in early 1533, so not even 11 years later, she was becoming Henry's wife in the very same palace.
Amazing.
It really is amazing. It's a story of a breathtaking rise and an equally breathtaking fall. And York Place, Whitehall Palace is at the center of really her adult life, which to me, it's such a shame that it is no longer in existence. It burnt down, I want to say, in the 17th century. Mm-hmm. But that's where things start to get a little murky for me, because once we're past the Tudors, I'm a medieval person and I'm a Tudor person. And then once we get too far past that, I start to get a little creeped out. But I wish we could go there. Wish it was like Hampton Court and we could go visit. And there really aren't very many records. There is an artistic rendering of I think it was called the Holbein Gatehouse, which is supposedly where they were married in secret in January 1533. And then Henry, he married Jane Seymour there, and then he died there. So it was a really important palace. And it was certainly important for the start of Anne Boleyn's career when it still belonged to Wolsey.
We could talk about this for 8 hours.
I told you I could, Rebecca. I honestly could. I think I could teach a semester long university course.
I think you could. And it's funny because you knew going into this, I didn't know very much. So I was a little bit worried I wasn't going to have enough questions, but we've filled an hour here. So
I know. I'm sorry about that. There are a couple things I can talk about a lot, and Anne Boleyn's one of them. Well, I have a lot of thoughts.
Thank you so much for being on the show today.
Yeah, thank you, Rebecca. I appreciate it. I hope you have a good night.
And that concludes this episode of the podcast. A special thank you to all of my Patreon patrons. If you'd like to become a patron, you can do so by going to Patreon. That's patreon.com/Tudors Dynasty, and click Become a Patron for options.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Tudors Dynasty podcast. You can follow and support the Tudors Dynasty podcast on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Patreon at Tudors Dynasty.